accession number 13460, Reel 1.
Recording of Mr. Peter Bouguet, interviewed by Rodney Giesler in Dulverton on the 9th of September 1993. To begin this interview, Mr. Bouguet, could you tell me when you were born, where you were born, and a bit about your family background?
I was born in Norway, a very small town on the west coast, called Kristiansund, which is unfortunate because it's the longest name any town in Norway, and I'd never really been there. But I still have to put it down on the passport every time I get a new one. And my father was an architect, and he got a job straight from university in Kristiansund. And I was born there in 1918. But we moved from there when I was 2 years old, down to town near Oslo. And most of my youth was spent there, near and in Oslo. My father is still an architect. And I went to school. All I ever thought of was flying. And there was not much to do with that in Norway. So I became interested in model aeroplanes. And spent all my time making flying model aeroplanes. Which was rather fun, because there weren't many people in Norway doing that either. So I won most of the competitions I entered, which is not difficult at all.
How did you come to actually fly, learn to fly?
Well, I wanted to fly. There was nothing else I wanted. My family didn't really want it, but the only way I could do it in Norway was to join the Air Force, as most... It really was the only way of getting into flying. And I applied, and I knew the right people, I thought. My father knew some people. There should be no difficulty getting into the Air Force. And I applied, and I was rejected. For one reason only. I was 2 inches too tall. And that was the biggest blow I've ever had in my life, I think. Because my school exams were pretty good. My sporting activities are quite good as well. A big, strong chap, but too big. That was the only thing I couldn't do anything about. Next year, I could have run 100 meter faster if I really tried. I could have sat my exams again, possibly improved upon them. But I thought being 2 inches too tall, that was really a very serious blow. So I took up the alternative, which was mining engineering, because my family wanted that for me. I stuck that for a year as an apprentice, which was very useful. Then a year at university. Then it became quite clear to me that I didn't want mining engineering, and I tried again for the Air Force, and I collapsed in all my joints, made myself 2 inches shorter, and I got in.
So there I was. In all your joints, which yes. You bend doubles.
And yeah, so knees and back and everything collapsed a bit, so I was the right height and everything else was fine.
So you joined the Royal Norwegian Air Force before the war then, did you?
Just before the war. I was very annoyed when the war started, because that was in the beginning of September, I think. And they had all our leave cancelled. I started in, I think, June in Air Force. I enrolled for a year, because any university student in Norway has to take 1 year military service to become a reserve officer. And you could choose either Air Force, Navy, or Army. So I chose the Air Force, of course.
And you learned to fly where?
Place just outside Oslo, Kjeller. It's still an Air Force base. had the flying school, and that was my first connection with de Havilland, because they had nothing but tiger moths. And we all learned on tiger moths, and well, it's a great little aeroplane. I still think so.
And that was your primary training then? What was your advanced training on?
Well, we had some rather ancient Fokker scouts biplanes. Fairly big, powerful machines, and they're slightly more advanced, much bigger, and fully equipped with machine guns and so on. And we also had some strange English aeroplanes, Armstrong, Whitworth, Scimitar, which were fighters. Nobody's ever heard of them, but they were fantastic little aeroplanes, very powerful, at least I thought so then, biplanes, extremely maneuverable, and we only had about three or four of those. And we were going to go on from there on to Gloucester Gladiators, which we just ordered quite a few. And also, we had ordered some Curtiss, very modern at that time, low-wing fighters. I forget their numbers. They're just starting to arrive when the war started in Norway, which was the 9th of April the following year. And they were just being assembled. They're waiting to fly because we couldn't fly those from Scheller because of the snow. Then a couple of Germans came and bombed a lot. So that was it. We were really furious, but just standing there. There's nothing anybody can do.
But what did you do? I mean, the Germans arrived on your doorstep, did they?
Yes, they did. We had couple of weeks of token resistance. There's nothing we could do as a flying unit. We tried to keep together because we weren't a fighting unit yet, and we just retreated up the valleys in eastern Norway, and we thought we could be useful in communications and so on, but never got as far as that, and the Germans kept pressing on at us. And then our commander negotiated a passage for it through Sweden. We were allowed to fly through Sweden to join the rest of the Norwegian forces, which were still fighting in the north of Norway. We couldn't go direct through because the Germans were in control of Trondheim, which is right in the middle. And then we all flew off to Sweden, and exactly half of us made it. It started off in a terrible snowstorm, the most perilous journey I've ever made in my life in an aeroplane, and I very nearly came to so many sticky ends on that trip. I only had about 100 flying hours or so, although I thought that was quite enough.
What were you flying at that?
Tiger moth.
On a tiger moth?
Yeah, yes.
And you landed where?
We hardly landed. I tried to follow a valley, which got steeper and steeper and smaller, and a small black V in front of me, bottom of the valley, and the bottom of the cloud got smaller and smaller. In the end, I had to get into a cloud, and we weren't terribly good at instrument flying, but I closed my eyes, practically, and got on minimum speed, so as to not to hit the mountainside too hard, and can't climb up. And when it was terribly bumpy, when it got reasonably smooth, I got up to about 5,000 feet. I knew I was well above any mountain range there, and set course east and stared east for half an hour. I knew I was in Sweden by then. I started letting down, down and down and down through the cloud. And nothing to be seen at all, just huge, great forest, great big pine trees. And I didn't have any maps. We'd been given look for one map before we started, but that was all. And so I had an engineer with me, tapped him on the shoulder, said, "Holt." And He prepared to clamber over the side and jump. I only had about 10 minutes fuel left. But, and then I suddenly remembered our struggle to get into the airplane. We had to struggle through about 3 feet of snow. And I thought, if we jump out here, we'll just never get anywhere at all. I better be with the airplane, maybe crash. At least somebody will find us. And then at last I spotted a road and a farmhouse and a tiny field, and made 3 attempts to get into the field, and finally clomped down in again in about 3 feet of snow. So it stopped almost instantly. Beautiful landing.
But your engineer had bailed out.
No, he hadn't. No, I managed to stop him. And so we struggled to the farmhouse, which made me realize just as well we hadn't, because only a couple of 100 yards took us half an hour to get there. So that was it. That was in turn in Sweden then. We weren't allowed to fly through because the Germans had heard of our little scheme and they put their foot down, and the Swedes, when the Germans said jump, they jumped. So that was it.
So how long were you interned for?
About 3 months. And then the war stopped in Norway, and we could do whatever we wanted. We could stay in Sweden. We could go on eastwards through Russia and join up in Canada. Or we can return to Norway. So I thought I can always get away from Norway, but I hadn't heard from my family for 3 months. So I wanted to get back and see what had happened. So I chose that and got back, and my family was there, all right. Then started straight away trying to escape to England or arrange an escape. And I thought the best way to do this would be to go back to university and start my studies again, because there'd be lots of people from there I would do this, and so they were, but it took a long time. It took 4 or 5 months to arrange to get a boat from the north of Norway, and then with 13 of us, 12, 13, and we set off from way up north in Norway.
Whereabouts?
Lofoten, and that was before the famous raid on Lofoten. Only a couple of months before, so if we'd stayed there, we could have had a free ride. But we all threw in what we had in the way of money, bought this boat, and we set off for Shetland, we thought. But that was on the beginning of February, and very, very nasty in the North Sea at that time. And we had full gales, and we never thought we'd make it, but we did. Not Shetland, but north of Scotland. We missed Shetland altogether because of gales, and there's no way of navigating because there's no sun. We're way above the Arctic Circle most of the time. But made it to Scotland, and that was that.
Presumably the weather helped your escape anyway, because the Germans...
Probably, yes. We never saw anything at all, not a sign of life. For 9 days. Absolutely nothing.
When you arrived in Scotland, were you welcomed, or how did you...
Oh, yes, indeed. Very welcome. We arrived in a little bay just off Cape Wrath, and we're absolutely worn out and sheltered in this bay. We're running out of water. There are plenty of food because nobody's eaten much. We've all been sick all the time. And so we got ashore and started collecting buckets of water. There's a farm trap standing top of the cliff there. And we got up to the farmhouse and said, can we get anywhere from here? No, so they've been cut off 2 weeks of snowstorms. Nowhere at all. And said, we said we'd just come from Norway. And I said, oh, yes, you're not the first ones. We had somebody like you 900 years ago in this bay. So that was it. We stayed there 3 days, recovered, and then set off for Thurso, which was the only port around there. And were welcomed there by a marvelous chap, Major, I think it was, Selvason, They've probably seen his name on huge great lorries going up and down M3, even down here. He's an importer of all sort of things. He's half Norwegian. And he made us very welcome, arranged everything for us. And we were sent down to London for interrogations, so on. Which, in our case, didn't last too long. There were people who were stuck in this interrogation unit for months, but I was only there for a day and just let off in London.
Was there much you were able to tell them?
Oh, quite a lot, yes. Mm. Oh, yes. We had collected, bales of newspaper, and I had masses of photographs and so on. So it was all very welcome, but it seemed, the whole thing seemed very casual. And nothing was very urgent, and I was very impatient to get going. But I was stuck in London for 3 months, doing nothing at all.
This was still 1940, was it?
41.
41.
So after the, after the Blitzkrieg, I had a night bombing that started in London, which was not very nice, but it was quite exciting. But I was very frustrated not being able to get flying and get going. I was given a test, by the way. I don't know if you heard of Wing Commander Pike, who was the station commander at Hatfield one time, also the commander of number 3 unit, elementary flying, I think. So he took me to Pangbourne, gave me a flying check, just to check my story.
In Pangbourne?
Yes, from Pangbourne. That was this. Perhaps I was late. No, from Hatfield, I think. It was still a grassy airfield by then. Mm. And in a tiger moth, just to see that I was speaking the truth. And he was happy with that. And that was it.
So you did this flight from Hatfield then?
Yes.
Not
my first introduction to Hatfield. And then I was sent through the whole rigmarole of RAF training, starting from the FTS. Which was a terrible bore. On time once again. And SFTS and OTUs and all that. Struggling all the way. The three of us together arrived in this boat. And on every posting, they tried to split us up. And everybody said, oh, if you're posted in the RAF, there is absolutely nothing you can do about it. You just do as you're told. So I wasn't used to be doing as I was told. So I said, I'm not accepting this. There are three of us and we won't stay together. And we did manage to stay together. Unfortunately, one of us was shot down near Oxford at Kidlington, flying Oxford. Our last flight from that unit, just flying a circular course, triangular course rather, around searchlights, just to get some night flying experience in, on our own in Oxford. And we had an arrangement in case of an air raid, these searchlights would dip down. And while I was up, these searchlights did dip down. And we were then to land immediately, as soon as we could. And so I got back to base. And doing terrible evasive action, looking over my shoulder all the time. And on the downwind leg, we were supposed to just flash our landing lights, just to show that we were there, prepared that we're coming in. I thought, well, German could be anywhere. The three of us doing exactly the same thing, the danger of collision is greater than the danger of being shot down. So I flashed my landing light. The bloody thing stuck on. So there I was flying like a torch through the sky. It had three positions, this landing light, up, down, and in the middle, which was off. And the middle just didn't work. So there I knew that if there was a German around, I should be the target. and did their most violent evasive action and managed to get in on the final. Top speed for the Oxford, and as I saw, about 200 feet up, a nasty rattle in the tail, and something flashed by me. And then, well, that was it. Ahead of me on the runway, there were four great crumps, and four bombs blew up. So I landed in amongst all that lot, and managed to taxi in at very high speed. Sergeant came roaring out, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" So you switch the bloody thing off, I can't. And he couldn't, I just ripped up the cables. So I wasn't really held to blame for that. I was very, very lucky indeed, because there'd been some shots through the elevator of the Oxford, and you could sight it from underneath, very low, this intruder, which was a JU-88, and a shot from underneath through the leading edge of the elevator and hit a reinforcement plate on the side of the fuselage. If that hadn't been there, half an inch either way would have gone straight through my back. So that was my first lucky escape in a war. One of the three of us had been shot down by this chap, so that determined me to go into night fighters, try and get my own back, because there was very little doing in daylight. And I thought, well, there's obviously not going to be much more day fighting. Not for a long time anyway, but night could be interesting. So that's what I did.
So that meant mosquitoes, did it?
Bow fighters, for a start. Mm-hmm. Mosquitoes weren't really in operation then. Or very few of them, anyway. But bow fighters, they're marvelous. The airplane. Most airplanes get somehow the reputation of being killers. Well, any airplane can be a killer. Anything from a microlight to super fighter, if you're careless with it. But if you treat them with respect, you can become very friendly with them, and they repay you good treatment and treat you well. Bowfighter was very, very strong.
If you lost an engine on takeoff on a bowfighter, it wasn't too happy, was it?
Not too happy, but it wasn't fatal. Well, my remaining friend nearly caught it that way, because he lost an engine on takeoff, and he crashed. Just a mile further on, and he was knocked out because he hit his head on the gun sight. But he had a very strong chap as an observer and managed to haul him out. And then the thing blew up and he was all right. So that could be nasty like that.
Now, the bow fighters have been fitted with AI by that.
Oh, yes, moment. Yes, yes.
Did you have any success?
Very little. There were hardly any Germans at all. My boss then was Cunningham, and he'd had quite a few successes, and he was desperately keen on flying, and of course he was the experienced night fighter pilot, and he was keen to collect as much as he could. And so nobody else got a chance, really. If there was anybody around, he got them. Which is the sort of thing he's kept up ever since.
Yeah. Where were you based on these?
First of all, Middle Wallop, the grass airfield. A nice place, old pre-war mess, very comfortable. And right in the middle of where you expected things to happen. Nothing much did, huh? I saw one Heinkel in all this time. On a day somewhat like this, raining, low cloud, when we were on reserve standby in daytime because the day fighters couldn't operate. This was during the period of the beam bombing by the Germans. They came in very high, on a beam of some sort, dropped bombs over Bath, Exeter even, all sort of places. And we were scrambled after two of these, Don Cunningham and myself, and we were both given contacts. And I closed in on my contact and got up, popped out of cloud about 20,000 feet. And there he was, just above the cloud, and I was closing in on him, and feeling rather vulnerable because he could obviously see me as a Heinkel. I wasn't worried about him firing at me because I had more guns than he had, but I was worried about him getting away, and he did get away. He did a total wing over, which was a big thing for Heinkel to do. And I followed him on the AI down through cloud, vertically down, which was a bit nerve-wracking, but there it was. And in the end, at about 6,000 feet, I thought, no, I'm going too fast and going downhill at a hell of a rate of knots, and I better pull out. So I did, and only just in time, I pulled out about 500 feet or so. Over the sea, just not far from the Isle of Wight, and there was no more contact. He disappeared from radar contact altogether. So I got back and landed, and wrote out my report. And Don Cunningham did the same, landed about the same time. He had exactly the same experience that I did. Saw the thing, and it died into cloud, and he followed it. Neither of us fired our guns. But then, while we were being debriefed, a message came in that there was one Heinkel being found crashed. And so we followed the trace on the radar, and it was the one he'd been following. So he was credited one more Heinkel without firing his guns at all. Mine, being identical, was over the sea, so it was probably in the sea, but there was no found. So he got his 24th, while I was still looking for my first.
So in both of those cases, you probably flew them into the ground then, because if you only pulled out at 500.
Yes, I know.
And you were flying a stronger aeroplane, I would imagine.
Yes.
He probably collapsed.
Yes, I'm sure it did. Yeah.
Anyhow, you went on flying both fighters for a bit?
For a bit, yes. There was very little doing in England, and I got fed up with hanging about and tried to transfer to Africa, where there was still a bit of war going on. So I managed to do that and join a squadron there, outskirt of Tunis, which is quite exciting. There's a bit of activity going on there. Not an awful lot, but I did manage to... one of the first things I did was to get behind an Italian and shoot him down. And then, short time after that, I had an urgent recall to England. And I thought, oh, good, we're going to start the front in Norway or something. So we wanted for that. I was sent back to Norway, to England, at a very leisurely pace, on a boat. Took 2 or 3 weeks to get from Africa to England, and nearly lethal, because whiskey was threepence a go. There was nothing else to do, sit and play poker and drink whiskey. But got home, and report...
Well, about 1943.
Yes. No, before that, 42, I think. Before that, and reported to the Norwegian headquarters, and I was given, torn off a most enormous strip for having shot down an Italian. Our CNC, an admiral, Ries Larsen, he said, you shouldn't have done that, because we were not at war with Italy. Now you've created all sorts of complications for us. And so...
The Italians have surrendered then?
No, no.
They hadn't.
Oh, no.
Oh, you mean Norway wasn't?
Norway was not at war with Italy, because Norway was only at war with Germany. Germany, of course, had invaded Norway. Well, we had no cause for complaint for the Italians.
So you were flying under RAF colours?
Yes, I was in the RAF, virtually. I had a small Norwegian flag on my uniform. And I was paid by the Norwegians, fortunately.
That meant more money, didn't it?
Much more money, yes.
Really?
Oh, yes, twice what the RAF were getting. Because the Norwegians were very rich in those days. We had a huge fleet out at sea, earning lots of money. And so they could afford to pay us quite well. But, as I said, you can't have that sort of thing going on. So I was reposted in England and joined a mosquito squadron. John Cunningham had been on the rest at this time. I should have been on the rest too, but I managed to get his posting to Africa instead. So I joined up with the Cunningham squadron again, and they were flying mosquitoes by now, stationed at West Malling. And there's a bit more activity there. This was the time when the flying bombs had started.